think we'll go ahead and get started, and I'll just give a brief overview of what I see going on in the economy and in the markets, talk a little bit about the developments, political developments, both in this country and abroad, and then I'll certainly address the question, Cheryl, that you emailed me earlier, which I thought was a good one. And we'll see what's of interest to people who dial in. What we have seen here over the last 6 months is a period of relative stability, with the manufacturing and industrial economies creating a base, and economic activity in those areas starting to firm up due to restocking of inventories and looking ahead to some moderate, very moderate economic growth overall. And so I think the panic has passed. Companies have by and large have a good deal of cash on hand, and while there remain some severe shortages of credit available, especially to small businesses, the financial situation certainly has stabilized. Now, the market rally in 2009, you can look at the extreme reduction in interest rates globally as a partial explanation. And of course, interest rates, the benchmark rate was just raised a couple of hours ago by the Fed by a quarter of a percent. And that's to be expected and likely going to continue through the year. And so these increases in interest rates will likely create substantial obstacles for the equity markets and even the bond markets to repeat or come anywhere close to the returns that they achieved last year. The energy markets have stabilized and started to creep back up upwards. The real estate market, which will talk a little bit more at length about, some parts of the real estate market are showing signs that they're not continuing to decline. Real estate really is a very large portion of the individual wealth market in the U.S. People's spending greatly depends upon their feelings of affluence that goes along with an increase or decrease in their home values. And in general, I think the U.S. is going to see an extended period where consumers continue to try and pay off debts and save for retirement. And this doesn't necessarily bode well for the classic kind of recovery, which is consumer-led, import-led, and where the other nations of the world who are reliant on U.S. Importing from them, that's what keeps their economies going. So I think we're headed into a very different kind of economic environment, where the Asian economies, especially those that have very strong balance sheets and young, educated populations, where they begin to develop their own domestic consumer markets, where they trade among themselves instead of relying on the U.S. To be the engine of economic growth, and that's I think a good thing for their economies. The debt issues that we face are very serious, but not crippling at the moment. As long as there are problems overseas, like in Greece and Spain and Portugal, and there will be credit and debt issues in many places, I think, in the upcoming year, China being one, and some of Eastern Europe and Latin America countries also, looking ahead to increased difficulty in making their debt payments, that all of that makes the U.S. a more attractive place for risk capital, for stock investing, and even the very, very low-paying U.S. treasuries or high-grade corporate markets here are very attractive to investors worldwide, because this whole kind of turmoil around sovereign debt, around countries like Greece or Iceland, those are the two countries we've seen. You don't hear much about Eastern Europe, but there are several countries there who cannot service their debt. We hear a little bit about California being in the same kind of situation financially in terms of not being able to service its debt without borrowing more. And that tends to be a downward spiral among nations, and I think it's very likely, almost assuredly, that the European Union will bail Greece out, because the credit and investor confidence problems that would be a result of Greece going down the tubes would be a lot like Lehman Brothers was in this country when they decided to not bail out Lehman Brothers. Everyone didn't know who was next, and investors froze up. And that could easily happen on an international scale if even these small countries like Greece or, it's much smaller than Italy or Portugal, but if any of them are allowed to go down the tubes. So I think we see a European bailout of Greece. Investors, they have this term in the investment world called bond vigilantes, which essentially means that when they see a weak player, they pounce upon it, and in stocks they would be shorting it, betting that it would go down, which tends to push the price down. The bond market, the same thing can happen. The same thing can happen with currencies when they perceive a weak country. The short-term traders can borrow money and leverage and bet that the momentum will continue, because in essence they create momentum going downwards, and it tends to be a downward spiral, a little bit like those triple twists or whatever you see in the half, what do they call that, snowboard event, half dome, half, I can't remember what they call that, half pipe. That half pipe. I'm sorry, I'm a little ignorant about the popular culture there. But the twists and turns that these people follow, that would be, you know, these economies on a downward spiral would look just really topsy-turvy, and the world is not ready for that yet. So I think we see a stabilization in Europe, but continued weakness versus the U.S. dollar. And so as a result, the investment strategy that we're following is greatly underweighting Europe at this point, both from a stock and a bond area. China is on the surface looks great, looks like growth is going well, employment, infrastructure building, but they are definitely in a bubble economy over there. The authorities are talking about cutting back on credit, but it's unlikely that they're going to be able to really institute any kind of fiscal discipline. And that probably is true about many, many countries around the globe that are just unable to cut social spending, increase taxes, tighten the belt. The problems in Japan are quite different. Japan has a problem where no one really is investing. Everyone is sitting on their hands and have been for 20 years. So Japan doesn't face that. Though they do have a high debt because they've been trying to stimulate their economy for about a decade now without much success. So the U.S., relatively speaking, is looking like the best among a bunch of bad horses. which, you know, I guess really makes a difference. You know, you're in a race, doesn't really matter if you're sort of semi-crippled, if everyone else is totally crippled, you're going to come out ahead and enjoy relative prosperity, despite the lack of fiscal discipline here and the inherent structural problems, which certainly as time goes on get worse. The whole budget issue, with 60% of the U.S. budget being entitlement programs that really can't be cut unless there's a huge change in the way that the society runs, the whole Medicare, Social Security, retiree benefits. I saw something today that said the gap between the amount of money that the state and local governments have and the amount that they owe their past employees, the retirement benefit gap is about $1 trillion. And $1 trillion is a fair amount of money. And that's not even talking about their operating deficits. So you have a situation, or we have a situation, all of us together, had a situation where the recession and the curtailment of employment, which continues at very high levels, unlikely to get better quickly, even with manufacturing and industrial output picking up nationwide. The number of jobs that will be created, you know, may be in the, well, I think, the 20 to 50,000 jobs a year, which is, you know, nothing like the 1.2 million jobs that have been lost since 2007. But the overall structure of the U.S. economy as being consumer led, with cheap imports, you know, some of that is likely to continue. The prospect for inflation is very low on the basis of the cost of imported goods. China is very willing to subsidize a low cost goods for the U.S. consumer just to keep their own employment on a relatively full basis. So we have been shorting China, the Chinese market, for a little while. Made about 30% in a couple of weeks, sold half the position, and I think that play still has some yet to unfold. On a strategy front, there are certainly companies that we're looking at buying for dividends or for market, you know, market dominators like Toyota. Everyone's aware of how bad Toyota has stumbled here this last month or so. Our view is that's a buying opportunity for Toyota stock. Same thing with Qualcomm, another example of a market dominating stock that has some temporary bad news. So, you know, we're looking selectively for buying opportunities. The concept of shorting markets, shorting just means that you make money when it goes down. So shorting the Chinese market to us means that as long as they're having an asset bubble like we had in 2005, 2006, 2007, they're having the same kind of real estate asset bubble now, with half the new residential units being bought by speculators, many of them just sitting empty, that has some kind of a day of reckoning in China, even though the Chinese government is able to very much arbitrarily tell people what to do and then get them to do it, get them to lend money or build bridges or I guess juggernaut, economic juggernaut is sort of the term that comes to my mind about China, that even that has its limits in terms of its effectiveness, especially when it comes to risk capital and the Chinese markets, being relatively new, are subject to a lot of seesawing emotional activity. So we may be a little bit ahead of the curve on that, but we are short that market. Another area, strategically looking at higher interest rates coming down the pike from the Fed, and also from the competition for capital to fund our debt. You know, we compete with all kinds of countries in issuing debt. We're considered to be a good risk, a good credit risk as a nation. I think in the news recently, you see that China has definitely reduced their holdings of U.S. debt because of their desire to diversify and other things going on over there. So, you know, the U.S. still is a beneficiary of being the currency of trade, of international trade. Our military, the projection of military power still gives us a lot of appeal to investors around the world who are worried about disruption in the European Union, for one, or, sort of rampant and persistent deflation in Japan due to their, you know, very elderly population, very low birth rate. So Japan is not really an attractive place to invest, nor is the European Union. So who's left? Who's left as real competitors to us, to the U.S. dollar? Well, there really isn't any other than sort of the oil exporting nations in China, the sort of manufacturing exporting nations, and maybe the emerging tiger nations of Asia, India, Indonesia. Those nations, could get together and create an alternative to the U.S. dollar. It's not going to happen overnight. So in many ways, we are still riding the wave of, affluence, of preeminence position in the world, with our energy cost relatively small compared with places like Japan and Europe that have to import pretty much, well, other than North Sea oil, pretty much import all their natural gas, coal, anything. The prospects for growth, kind of summarizing and wrapping up the overview, the growth prospects are fairly muted. Globally, there are some countries that have sort of much higher growth prospects, primarily in Asia. The likelihood of interest rate rises are on the horizon, not necessarily because there's inflation, but just because of the competition for capital. And traditional view of investing is, buy low, sell high. Well, how do you buy low? You buy on overreaction of the markets to bad news. And I would put the state of California in that realm as well, just not necessarily the state of New Mexico or Colorado, because the finances are in pretty good shape in New Mexico and Colorado. But certainly in California, the news is going to get a lot worse. Bond yields, the interest rates that they pay, are likely going to increase. And lots of political kind of chain-rattling threats back and forth between the state government and federal government. And kind of watch Greece, and you'll see a repeat between California and D.C. in terms of the negotiations. What are you going to do to fix your problems? In the end, the central banks or the Federal Reserve and come to the rescue. They just cannot afford a major disruption, and so that provides a buying opportunity in the bond area. And as I mentioned before, in the stock area, just looking for really very top-notch global companies who are undergoing some what we consider to be temporary trials and tribulations that provides us with buying opportunities. So With that, let me turn to a question that Cheryl emailed about real estate, and then I'll throw it open and see if there are any other questions. I'm talking a mile a minute because I'm drinking coffee, and that's a little unusual for me. So just break in and ask questions when you feel like it. Cheryl's questions was if I could address the real estate market and its effect on the economy and how long I see the difficulties in the real estate market continuing. Is that a fair recap of your question, Cheryl?
Yes, I had to take you off mute because
okay.
of the puppies. Yes, it is. Thank you.
Okay. No wonder it's so quiet. We have Jeff, you know, in California enjoying the great outdoors and you enjoying the great indoors.
Yeah, it's nice to be home.
Yeah. So the real estate market is, I think, still in terrible shape, by and large. It's hard because you don't really have a sense of where it's at unless you're actually in the market buying or selling. Other than that, you know, you can't talk to a realtor and get a straight answer. I happen to be involved in a number of real estate transactions at the moment, and we are buying things at certainly 30% below where they were a year ago, probably 40% where they were 2 years ago, and there's a lot on the market. There's a lot that's been taken off the market, both residential and commercial. And the problems that we will see in the next year, if they come to the public's attention on the part of banking, will be from real estate problems. The government's efforts to stabilize the market have helped. They certainly have not changed the basic economics of the situation where people flat out just can't afford. They bought more than they could afford, and they can't afford it no matter what the government does. So the government may have refinanced or amended, I think 60,000 mortgages. They may be targeting another 600,000 mortgages. But the majority of those people will end up defaulting or back in trouble. And that's just the reality. It's the experience that everyone's had. And now the government's, you know, given these $8,000 tax credits or whatever, and that's helped sales somewhat. But with unemployment so high, and the prospects for most people, future income that does not look like they're going to be able to, you know, keep moving up in size and in the expensive housing. So the residential real estate market, while it may not be declining anymore, I don't think that the real extent of the damage is known yet, because there are a lot of these programs from the government are going to end, and the foreclosures will start to mount again, and inventory will go up. So I think that goes on, and that affects consumer spending and the economy as a whole. If mortgage rates start to move up, with the Fed trying to figure out how to reduce the deficit and not continue to pour money into stabilizing the banks and the car companies, et cetera, the real estate market is likely going to take another hit. And right now it's very difficult to get loans unless, you know, you're overqualified. And so the banks are not really helping that. Not that that's their job to fix people's problems, but the commercial real estate market, lots of vacancies. I think a lot of retailers have gone out of business. A I'm sure that's true everywhere. I know it's true in New York and Santa Fe and Southern California. Those are the three places that I spend the most time in. Denver seems to be fairly strong from that perspective, but the regional banks, the main commercial lenders on the block, are definitely due to take some more hits on commercial real estate. So real estate is a drag on the economy, and I just don't see any solution to it other than just time. Having time elapse, having people finally saying, I've had enough, I want to sell my property at whatever price, and then we have a bottom. People are able to get into rentals fairly cheaply, or you know, young people are able to buy homes a lot cheaper now than they were a couple of years ago. And, you know, there's pain among people who extended themselves with loans or speculative investors. And that's just, you know, kind of the way the cookie crumbles sometimes. So, Cheryl, does that pretty much address your question?
Yeah, you know, it's just the curiosity about it. But, you know, the main thing was, how long do you think it's going to last? And I don't really think you know, and anybody knows. It sounds like,
no.
You know, it's just got to wait till the worst gets, it bottoms out before, you know, I guess.
You know, the key to all of this, really, to the deficit, to housing, is growth, and the Obama projections that show the deficit declining after, you know, ballooning the last 2 years, rely on a 4% annual growth rate from 2012 through 2015 and 16. 4 years of steady 4%.
It's projected then.
That's all projected. That's right. And so that's really the only thing that will sap up the inventory of unsold homes and create really a modestly increasing price forecast for real estate. And that's still, you know, dependent on job growth, and that the rising interest rates don't choke off the housing economy. So that's a lot of ifs. And really, it's kind of curious that everyone's hoping for, at least in Europe, everyone's hoping to export their way out of their economic doldrums. And basically, you can't have everybody exporting and nobody importing. You know, not all the nations of the world can run a surplus, a trade surplus, and that's what everyone is trying to do. So far, you know, the central governments have coordinated their efforts, and they have not sort of allowed their politicians to degenerate into sort of international, you know, beggar thy neighbor policies where everyone's trying to outdo their neighbor. So my prognosis really is for a fairly long period of anemic growth, which is a heck of a lot better than Japan has experienced, with no growth for 20 years and actual deflation, negative growth. And Europe is just facing, you know, much different but equally serious problems. I think more serious problems. They're facing a fundamental lack of policy coordination, a lack of social coordination, a very high social program costs. And, you know, not that we're not getting up there. There's a lot of things on the books which are spending money on social things, which, you know, may be good from an ethical perspective, but from a financial perspective, they are all pointing to deeper trouble down the road unless we have growth. What might create growth? Who knows? A new energy technology, disarmament of nuclear nations could create a release of resources to more productive use. Who knows? But that's the magic of projections, is you don't have to quite explain how you get back to 4% growth. So without that, we face higher deficits, slower growth, and not necessarily inflation in basic, you know, material goods that can be imported, but certainly at some point, and I'll kind of wrap it up with this, getting back to Greece, so the lesson from Greece is when you lose the confidence of the international investment community, you pay through the nose, and you lose autonomy. And Greece is not going to be the last country we see this happen to in 2010. I think you might see it in Italy, Portugal, England is a possibility, France. You don't hear about, I can't remember whether it's Lithuania or Romania, some Estonia, some of those countries have, are facing the same kind of scenario as Lehman Brothers and Bear Stearns and Merrill Lynch's and all those. So it ought to be an interesting year. Maybe I'll throw it open. Jeff, are you still on the phone? Do you have any questions or topics?
Rob, I'm good. Thank you.
Okay. Cheryl, any other questions or things you'd like to hear me address?
Well, this could get more involved than we have time for, but...
That's okay.
Overall, how do you think our president's doing?
You know, it's a good question. Clearly the guy is well-intentioned, very smart. He is a consensus builder. He's trying to get something done. I think, his focus on Afghanistan, is the right one. I think his rapport with some of our allies around the world has definitely been beneficial to world peace, or at least security. On the financial side, it's like healthcare. There are definitely missed opportunities for real reform, and the time may be past now to get it done. Healthcare reform, I think, is essentially shot. The reform of the financial, there are some packages coming out, but I'm not quite sure that Obama has the strength to actually get anything through on the health care front or the financial overhaul front. I think the lobbyists in that recent Supreme Court ruling that allows corporations to essentially spend as much as they want on political campaigns sort of goes back, if you all are aware of that, that's a very big deal where the Supreme Court said you can't restrict political activities of corporations. So the ability of anyone to navigate through the system as it exists now, I think, is limited, no matter how talented they may be personally. And I think if we go down the road a couple of years, and I think it's likely that the Democrats lose effective control of the Congress this fall. I think that's very likely. Then you see, the markets like that in some sense, because they like to see sort of paralysis on the part of Congress. So I don't know. I think he's done as good as anyone can do, but and we've enjoyed a relative stability here, as I started off saying, the first 6 months. So maybe that continues on, and there's a lot of unknowns that will still come to play. So I don't really have a sort of an ethical or an overall judgment about how he's doing it. To me, the system is probably not up to the challenges of the circumstances that we face, just the basic structure. But that's a different issue.
Yeah, really? Where do you start?
It's
kind of like if they got Medicare, if they were able to fix all the Medicare problems, then maybe the health care issue wouldn't be such a problem.
Right. But, I don't really see anyone having the ability to make any real changes on a regular, you know, on a legislative front because of the basic conflicts that these individual representatives are in.
Yeah, and they're not, you know, they said something I heard, well, there I go, listening to the news, but somebody said something, this is an election year, so nothing's going to get done. It's just really stupid.
Yeah.
Well,
it's,
thank you so much, Rob. I mean, this has just been great.
You're very welcome.
And Jeff, have a great time out there.
Thanks, I appreciate that. You too. That's going to be great.
I just got back from there, and it's so beautiful out there.
I know, it's 80 degrees.
Crazy. I know. It's 50 here today. It's not too bad. Yeah.
Yep. We're all very fortunate, and
we are.
You know, hopefully we pass that around, and you know, I guess as a closing comment, I think, you know, overall, it's likely that even if our political system is ineffective for change, and let's say China's on the other end, they're too effective as a juggernaut. That somewhere the two nations come together and you know, realize that, you know, the exploitation of resources in Africa and Latin America can only happen to a certain point anymore, given the modern world, and that, you know, they understand that the U.S. can't default on its debt, that China can't, you know, play all of its cards just for its own benefit, because in the end it just doesn't work. So I think that's, you know, that's my great hope, is that, you know, sort of we may have to go through these things economically, but we're not necessarily fighting militarily. So that's the good news.
Mm.
All right.
Yeah, thank you, Rob.
Okay. You're welcome.
One short question. So,
sure.
If you were going to sell your house, is waiting not the answer? Is it just going and do it and take the hit on what it used to be? And
I don't know. You know, if you're in your house and you're comfortable and you're not in a hurry, I think it's worthwhile putting it on the market and waiting. If you're in a hurry to sell it, then dropping the price is what needs to be done. You know, I'm involved in selling a house that I own, and I'm torn between renting it for another year or dropping the price and trying to sell it. And it really, in some ways, just depends on the current benefit from staying in the house. Like, you know, if you're in your house and you'd be paying X number of dollars in rent somewhere else, well, essentially, you know, maybe you've got a 4% return on your real estate, even if you're not seeing it, just because you're not paying rent. And
right.
In that sense, you're not under time pressure. And I think, you know, certainly the market ought to be stronger in 2 years than it is today.